Hello, hello, hello. Here's Malanka with another episode from Sri Aurobindo, The Synthesis of Yoga. The object of the material life must be to fulfill, above all things, the vital aim of nature. The whole aim of the material man is to live, to pass from birth to death with as much comfort or enjoyment as may be on the way. But anyhow, to live. He can subordinate this aim, but only to physical nature's other instincts, the reproduction of the individual, the conservation of the type in the family, class, or community. Self, domesticity, the accustomed order of the society and of the nation are the constituents of the material existence. Its immense importance in the economy of nature is self-evident, and commensurate is the importance of the human type which represents it. He assures her of the safety of the framework she has made and of the orderly continuance and conservation of her past gains. But by that very utility, such men and the life they lead are condemned to be limited, irrationally conservative, and earthbound. The customary routine, the customary institutions, the inherited or habitual forms of thought, these things are the life breath of their nostrils. They admit and jealously defend the changes compelled by the progressive mind in the past, but combat with equal zeal the changes that are being made by it in the present. For to the material man, the living progressive thinker is an ideologue, a dreamer, a madman. The old Semites, who stoned the living prophets and adored their memories when dead, were the very incarnation of this instinctive and unintelligent principle in nature. In the ancient Indian distinction between the once-born and the twice-born, it is present to this material man that the former description can be applied. He does nature's inferior works. He assures the basis for her higher activities, but not to him easily are opened the glories of her second birth. Yet, he admits so much of spirituality as has been enforced on his customary ideas by the great religious outbursts of the past. And he makes in his scheme of society a place, venerable, though not often effective, for the priest or the learned theologian who can be trusted to provide him with a safe and ordinary spiritual pabulum. But to the man who would assert for himself the liberty of spiritual experience and the spiritual life, he assigns, if he admits it all, not the vestment of the priest, but the robe of the sannyasin. Outside society lets him exercise his dangerous freedom. So he may even serve as a human lightning rod, receiving the electricity of the spirit and turning it away from the social edifice. Nevertheless, it is possible to make the material man and his life moderately progressive by imprinting on the material mind the custom of progress, the habit of conscious change, the fixed idea of progression as a law of life. The creation by this means of progressive societies in Europe is one of the greatest triumphs of mind over matter. But the physical nature has its revenge, for the progress made tends to be of the grosser and more outward kind, and its attempts at higher or more rapid movement bring about great weariness, swift exhaustions, startling recoil. It is possible also to give the material man and his life a moderate spirituality by accustoming him to regard in a religious spirit all the institutions of life and its customary activities. Now, the creation of such spiritualized communities in the East has been one of the greatest triumphs of spirit over matter. Yet here, too, there is a defect, for this often tends only to the creation of a religious temperament, the most outward form of spirituality. Its higher manifestations, even the most splendid and puissant, either merely increase the number of souls drawn out of social life, and so impoverish it or disturb the society for a while by a momentary elevation. The truth is that neither the mental effort nor the spiritual impulse can suffice, divorced from each other, to overcome the immense resistance of material nature. She demands their alliance in a complete effort before she will suffer a complete change in humanity. But usually, these two great agents are unwilling to make to each other the necessary concessions. The mental life concentrates on the aesthetic, the ethical, and the intellectual activities. Essential mentality is idealistic and a seeker after perfection. The subtle self, that brilliant Atman, is ever a dreamer. A dream of perfect beauty, perfect conduct, perfect truth, whether seeking new forms of the eternal or revitalizing the old. But it's the very soul of pure mentality. But it knows not how to deal with the resistance of matter. There it is hampered, inefficient. It works by bungling experiments and has either to withdraw from the struggle or submit to the gray actuality. Or else, by studying the material life and accepting the conditions of the contest, it may succeed, but only in imposing temporarily some artificial system, which infinite nature either rends and casts aside or disfigures out of recognition, or by withdrawing her assent, leaves as a corpse the dead ideal. Few and far between have been those realizations of the dreamer in man which the world has gladly accepted and looks back to with a fond memory and seeks, in its elements, to cherish. Now, when the gulf between actual life and the temperament of the thinker is too great, we see as the result a sort of withdrawing of the mind from life, in order to act with a greater freedom in its own sphere. The poet, living among his brilliant visions, the artist absorbed in his art, the philosopher thinking out the problems of the intellect in his solitary chamber, the scientist, the scholar, caring only for their studies and their experiments, were often in former days, are, even now, not unoften the sannyasins of the intellect. To the work they have done for humanity, all its past bears record. But such seclusion is justified only by some special activity. Mind finds fully its force and action only when it casts itself upon life and accepts equally its possibilities and its resistances as the means of greater self-perfection. In the struggle with the difficulties of the material world, the ethical development of the individual is firmly shaped, and the great schools of conduct are formed. By contact with the facts of life, art attains to vitality, and thought assures its abstractions. The generalizations of the philosopher base themselves on a stable foundation of science and experience. This mixing with life may, however, be pursued for the sake of the individual mind and with an entire indifference to the forms of the material existence or the uplifting of the race. This indifference is seen at its highest in the Epicurean discipline and is not entirely absent from the Stoic. And even altruism does the works of compassion more often for its own sake than for the sake of the world it helps. But this too is limited fulfillment. The progressive mind is seen at its noblest when it strives to elevate the whole race to its own level, whether by sowing broadcast the image of its own thought and fulfillment, or by changing the material life of the race into fresh forms, religious, intellectual, social, or political, intended to represent more nearly that ideal of truth, beauty, justice, righteousness, with which the man's own soul is illumined. A failure in such a field matters little, for the mere attempt is dynamic and creative. The struggle of mind to elevate life is the promise and condition of the conquest of life by that which is higher even than mind. What a grand place to pause for today. Thank you for listening to Auraville Radio, to Sri Aurobindo, to the Synthesis of Yoga. May some light permeate the darkness within us all. May we strive towards truth. And my fond wishes for a lovely day for each of you. Bye for now. Marlanka signing off.
This is Auraville Radio, voices from the City of Dome.